Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Climate Stand with The Final Stand. I, Nanki, and my fellow TFS member, Shalini, will be your host for this episode. Now I hand the mic to Shalini to introduce you to our guest for the day.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. And thank you, Nanki, for that introduction. Today, we have a very special guest with us, Professor Cosmin Kurandia. Dr. Kurandia is the Vice Dean and a professor at Jindal School of Environment and Sustainability, and is also a professor at Jindal Global Law School, which is where Nanki and I currently study. He is credited for his seminal book called Legal Protection of the Sinking Island Refugees, and he's also initiated and developed the international hybrid law concept, which sort of synergizes human rights, environmental and refugee migration laws in international climate law. Professor Kurandia has also worked at the United Nations University in Germany, served as a lecturer at University of Bonn in Germany, and has been an AXA postdoctorate fellow. He currently also acts as a senior legal research fellow with the Center for International Sustainable Development Law in Canada and lecturer for University for Peace in Costa Rica. Dr. Kurandia recently authored the Plan Relocation Guidelines, which is a framework to undertake climate change-related relocation, and has also authored the displacement guidelines in the context of climate change and disasters. So both these policies were for the government of Fiji. Thank you so much for being here, Professor. And in today's episode, we will be discussing climate displacement briefly with Professor Kurandia, who, as we've already sort of seen from his introduction, is an expert on the same. So not to waste any more time, let's just get right into it.
Thank you. So as we discussed, today we will be talking about both climate change displacement and your time at the COPs. So let's start a little bit with the COP side of the conversation. So Professor, could you please briefly tell our listeners what exactly the COP is, what role does it play in climate change mitigation, and your personal association with it across the years?
Okay, so first of all, I'm very happy to be here. This is my first interview with you, so I'm delighted to do this. When it comes to the COP, which is an abbreviation for the Conference of Parties, this is taking under the regime of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, which was established back in 1992. Along with other two conventions under the Rio Declarations, Earth Summit in Rio in Brazil, which happened back in 1992. And it's actually the space where every year negotiators for all the signatories to the convention are actually gathering to talk, to negotiate, to dispute, and to find solutions for fighting and combating climate change. It's taking place every year on another continent. It's by rotation. Last year was supposed to take place in Glasgow in Scotland. It was cancelled due to COVID-19. Now it took place in Glasgow earlier November. And next year, it will take place in Africa, in Egypt. So we're going to have an African COP. I started to join the environment of the COPs around 2005, a master's student. And since then, I went to most of the COPs in different perspectives. Wearing different hats, sometimes representing a non-governmental organization as a student at the beginning, being more of an observer, and then slowly getting involved into things due to my association with the United Nations, for which I worked for 7 years. And lately, you go on the third side. The first side will be actually the governments, the parties to the COP, and now representing different countries depending on the interests and on the work I'm conducting for those respective parties. So more or less, there is a vast experience in the COPs. And I can tell you the peak of all of them was by far 2015, when I was seconded from the United Nations University for which I worked at that time. I was seconded to United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC Secretariat, to the legal team of the UNFCCC, which actually helped to contributed to the establishment of what we know today as being the Paris Agreement in December in Paris in 2015. And by far, that was the peak of my participations. You didn't ask me that, but I can tell you this, because that was the peak of all my participations from COP.
Thank you so much, Professor. That was really interesting. We actually, Nanki and I had a chance to witness a little bit of COP26 through your eyes during Professor Ishan and your webinar or discussion, where you had a conversation about COP26 and also showed us around the place a little bit. So that was really interesting, and we had a lot of fun actually experiencing it a little bit, however far away we were. Now circling back to our main theme for this episode, which is climate change displacement, how would you, Professor, explain climate-induced displacement to a layman, and what is the evidence of it in the world, like, and especially in India, if you could?
Well, let's have a structural answer to this question. Climate-induced displacement, or just simply, in a better legal accepted terminology, climate displacement, because inducement gives a sense of exclusivity, which is not the case. It has the two magic words, climate and displacement. So before anything, before you need to know what climate is, and you need to know what displacement is. And a little bit more than that, you actually need to believe in climate change. And you actually be aware of the fact that as a subsidiary consequence, as I call it, for a few years now, displacement is happening due to climate change. Talking about climate change, well, it exists. We know that for already some maybe 30, 40 years, I will say 40, 1988, when IPCC was established, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That was like, if you want, the point where the international recognition came alive. And it's around, and it's becoming more aggressive, more visible. And if you are reading the projections coming from the same IPCC, from the reports, the assessments reports they are issuing every time and then, you're gonna notice that it's probably the biggest threat of our lives, of our century, if you want, the biggest threat to humanity, which is not actually man-made. And that's a paradox, because climate change is a man-made activity. And it would be for the first time, for example, in the world, in the history of humankind, when a civilization, like the civilizations of the small island states in the Pacific, and not only Pacific, all oceans, will actually disappear. It is the first time when a civilization disappears without war. We had civilizations and we had countries disappearing from the political map of the world as a consequence of war, of conflict, of colonization, and so on. However, we never faced before a country simply disappearing from the map just due to, let's call it, I won't call it natural consequences, I'll call it just climatic consequences. So that's unique. And unfortunately, this is, as I said before, it's more and more visible. So with this, hopefully more and more people are becoming aware of that, and politicians are actually paying more attention to that. This is climate change. Displacement, well, displacement, it's an element of human mobility, is the bad element, the bad guy, if you want, of the human mobility concept. You have migration, which is a good thing. It's positive. It defines us. Migration happened for almost 2,000 years. It made us, and it still makes us, actually what we are. We are all migrants, from tourists to from labor workers to students to people seeking medical coverage and so on and so on. So we are all migrants at some point in our lives. Even if you are moving from a state to another, you are still going to be a migrant. So that's the positive part. Well, when then on the other side of the coin, you have displacement where people have to move. They are forced to move. It's not a voluntary choice. And this is the main characteristic which makes it the bad guy. People are moving against their will. So if we, and the third element, which we don't cover yet, I don't know if we are covering later, but I don't think so, is the relocation, which it's a little bit of a different animal. Well, if we're putting these two things together, climate displacement, it becomes a little bit frightening. It becomes a little bit frightening because it should be, because if you are taking the last statistics from the numbers of IDMC, for example, which is an organization in Geneva dealing with counting the people who are on the move due to different triggers in the world, you're going to see that the climate displacement or people and disasters, so environmental degradation in general, in the last year has tripled in compared with the people, for example, who are being displaced or forced to move due to COVID. So we have more people displaced now than we had before, and we have more people displaced now due to climate change and disasters than we had from conflict. So initially we had only conflict, then it came and it was maybe an around equal kind of portion. And now the displacement due to climate change and disasters tripled. And unfortunately, again, the projections are not, are not so shiny. They're gonna probably, the number will continue to increase as the number of the climatic events will continue to increase. It's a direct proportionally result. Well, this is what I will explain to a layman, and this is what the people should understand, that it's a very serious issue which is probably going to characterize the next 50, 100 years. We're going to hear more of people being displaced due to climate change and disaster than to conflict. And even during the pandemic, although there was a tendency to believe that the nature and the environment has the capacity to recover itself, which is on one hand true, but on the other hand, due to the main activity, which was so severe after the mid of the 20th century, even if we stop today our entire contribution to climate change, carbon emissions, pollution, and so on, the climate change will continue to manifest itself. And this is simply, and this is if you put it during the COVID period in the last 2 years, you're going to observe that even that the man activity was drastically reduced due to the pandemic, still climatic stressors were present and increased and more aggravated and more records of new heat years more and more negative records in regards to the impacts of climate change. Well, the evidence in the world, I think it's evident. I believe it's everywhere. It's being seen on TVs, in the media. You can see it everywhere. If you have a rapid onset event, like a hurricane, a cyclone, a tsunami, for example, you're going to notice immediately the huge number of people who is being affected by that. Well, when it comes to India, we did not have before climate change displaced people cross-borderly. Now they started to appear. internally, we had climate change in displaced people. However, we considered them as being as part of the natural way of things, of the natural way of us treating the environment and not paying so much attention to the consequences. That would be my answer to the layman.
Thank you so much, Professor, especially the insight I think you gave on the pandemic, because that's something we are all experiencing personally. And as you said, there have been these observations about the earth healing itself, but there's actually another background story to it, which we recognize being on the other side of the spectrum, especially you as an expert. Now, Professor, when you were giving the example of India, you mentioned that there were certain cases of climate-induced migration that were existing, but you weren't labeling it as such. So what is the relevance of terminology in this sphere, in this new developing topic? Does terminology matter? And are there any existing legal mechanisms in place for the protection of migrants of climate change?
Well, to be honest to you, I am obsessed with terminology. As a lawyer, I cannot be otherwise. I think the correct terminology, it's very important when we are making the math of the impacts, when we are actually labeling, as you said, different types of or categories of people or events. So I think before we accept the right terminology, or before we are embracing the right terminology, which I believe is, as I said, very, very important, because only by that time everyone could be considered being on the same page. Well, we have to embrace the impacts and the triggers and the consequences of climate change. And this is something which, unfortunately, some of us are not willing to do. It's happening in general in the world that politicians have a tendency to think on a very short term. They are thinking about their re-election, about 4 years, another 4 years, another cycle and another cycle. And they are thinking in very short term. Very few politicians or leaders in the world have actually this capacity to actually foresee and project these impacts or project the challenge of climate change, as you see today, in the future. It's called an intergenerational approach. And thinking of you, not about the next generation, which is around 25 years usually, not the next generation, but the fourth or the fifth generation from now on, which gives you a projection of around 100 years. And there are very, very few leaders in the world who are thinking over the next 100 years. Humanly speaking now, if you take any of us, nobody will think of 100 years from now because we know we won't live that much. And secondly, if you are a little bit pragmatic about the reality which is around us, which is again very challenging itself, economically, socially, culturally, and so on. So we already facing challenges. Why should we care about this intergenerational approach and think of what is happening on Earth in 100 years? Well, the answer is simple. It's a little bit ethical, but it's simple. It's just because we are visiting here, right? We are visiting here in our life cycle for a number of years, and then we are living and then eventually come back or not come back, depending on the religious angle of looking at things. But what matters is that our life, it's a very short, it has a very short term in this projections. So, but our contribution is opposite, could be huge. We can damage the earth in 70 or 80 years or 100 years, how long we live on this earth, to be impacted for the next 200 or 300 years. While we are, don't have the capacity, or very few of us have, has to actually to impact positively for the next 200 years, the Earth, in our life cycle of 70 years, 80 or what, 100 years, how long we are here. So this being said, I think it's a change of mentality. It's a change of mentality which should come from the young generations, if you ask me. I think we're going to talk a little bit later about that. But it should be coming from the people who are going to be more affected than, for example, my generation. Yes, I'm not sure I'm going to be here in 2100, where most of the projections are actually looking terrible. And the map, as we see it, it's crippled, because we're going to probably, if we do not do anything about this, we're going to be around 3.5, 4 degrees Celsius. And if you are just doing a simple exercise of Googling world map after 4 degrees, you're going to see countries crippled and territories crippled. And that means people crippled as well. And lives and livelihoods and so societies and civilizations, which we talked a little bit earlier. So I think this should come from the young generation more. And before, as I said, embracing the right terminology, you have to embrace the concept of climate change, the fact that it's here, and unfortunately it's here to stay. And more than that, you have to do something about it. If you are a politician, if you are a civil society representative, if you, regardless what role on earth you have to do something about it and not think just on a very short term. This is what I believe it's missing in the world in general, not necessarily in India, but in the world in general. And due to this fact, very few leaders are actually addressing it on a medium long-term perspective. They are just addressing on a very short term. And the things are moving very slowly compared with climate change, which is moving very fast. The degradation is going very fast. For, I will give an example. If IPCC in assessment report number 3 actually established that it's around 50 to 75 millimeters per year of the sea level rise, now we are getting almost 100 centimeters per year of a sea level rise. So it's more and more aggressive. So we are going faster towards what we don't want to go to. And our actions are actually slower. And we do have obligations. We do have international obligations under the Paris Agreement, if we sign that, and most of the countries, actually almost most of the countries signed the Paris Agreement, which created some legal obligations, international legal obligations. However, due to the nature of Paris Agreement, it's an attitude of the countries to actually determine how they are actually contributing towards combating climate change. It's not something mandatory, it's not something obligatory, which forces the country to obey this treaty. It's a different type of a treaty, and this is the best compromise which could have been achieved. And now that we are seeing the reactions of the countries are still feeling comfortable, and they should not.
Thank you so much, Professor. Professor, I think when you were explaining to us about policy, you identified a lot of different groups that are present in the climate change universe. The problems of intergenerational groups, different populations, we have different cultural interests. There's the question of whether change needs to be made at a national level or international level. Who is responsible, the expert or the politician? So in light of these different groups, what do you think would be ideal, given that you've also been part of these international negotiations? You've seen these different groups come together on the same table to discuss common agendas. If you had to contextualize that to our issue at hand, how do you think these two worlds can come together to help the issue of climate-induced displacement in terms of international policy?
Well, It's a little bit easy to respond to that, because if we're thinking of the group of interest, group of interest are mostly based on economies like G20 group, for example, and China, or geographically like the African group, the small islands, development states, the OASIS, the alliance of the state islands, and so on and so on. So you have different groups geographically or based on the same, if you want, economics or on the same interests. However, if you put, I gave the example of the politicians before, but if you take on one in this group, well, it really doesn't matter which one, and you have, let's say, a group of 20 politicians, if 20 politicians coming as a group representing a specific geographical area and thinking alike on a very short term, why? Well, the result would be quite easy to see. The attitude of the group, the agenda of the group will be on very short term thinking. So you see, if you are, there is a joke that if you have one politician or you have five politicians, it's actually the same thing. Well, sometimes, unfortunately, this is true. So the attitude of the groups comes from the agenda of the countries. It's very rarely when in one group you have a differentiated opinion. And usually the differentiated opinions are actually very fast assimilated by the rest of the group. So it's not necessarily the case. If you are a leader yourself, in climate change negotiations, I would think as leadership of the United States, of European Union, of China, for example, or Russia, maybe sometimes India or Brazil. When if you are a leader and you are taking by yourself, you don't need necessarily, you can express your own opinion without the support of the group. So the ideal group, to answer your question, will be to have a group where at least one or several politicians have a different perspective over this intergenerational approach. And it's actually reflecting the interest of combating climate change and faster, and not necessarily by words, but by action. And this will be the ideal group. When it's coming to displacement, well, for example, COP26, unfortunately, wasn't a very good example on when we're talking about displacement. It was a little bit addressed under the loss and damage episode of the COP, which is a good thing because there some financing came alive, which, among others, can actually address displacement as well. However, it wasn't a separate issue because it's just a consequence. It's a subsidiary consequence. Before you have displacement or people being forced to move, if you are looking into the hybrid theory, you're going to see that before that, human rights are breached. Human rights are violated. So before they take the decision to stay or to go. So what happens, for example, if you have a high rate of pollution, for example, in a city, then the rights of the people are being violated in mass. They don't have the right to a clean environment, which is recently was established by the Human Rights Commission that it is a universal right, regardless of your conventions, constitutions, treaties, rules, or whatever. So you don't have the clean air to breathe. Your right to health is affected. Your right to work sometimes is affected due to the polluting conditions and so on and so on. So a bunch of rights, all the rights are actually associated with climate triggers. And most of the rights, unfortunately, are associated with pollution, as our an example. So the people are looking themselves and they have two choices, actually. They stay and they continue their life within that environment, polluted environment, with the consequences they're going to definitely face, health-wise, social-wise, cultural-wise, labor-wise, and so on. Or they move. But in order to move, you require some kind of capacity. human capacity, financial capacity, you know, a labor capacity, a destination, and so on. So you need some capacity, which unfortunately, vulnerable people, as the most affected group of people, if you want, by climate change, does not have it. So before displacement, human rights violations happened. And within, if we'll have an ideal group addressing that, well, I'm going to say that that action, which comes from this idealism, which will characterize the negotiation group, will have definitely addressing displacement. Displacement, it's very tricky here. Displacement is not a government responsibility, if you want. Displacement is a proof that government failed to provide the protection. Nobody wants to leave. You are leaving and you are actually forced to leave only if you don't have a choice, a better choice. And that better choice comes from adaptation. And when the state fails to provide you with means for adaptation, then you move, you are forced to move because you cannot continue under the same circumstances. So it's not necessarily, it's not the displacement, it's showing actually, is showing the incapacity of the state to actually provide. And more than that, displacement is not a governmental issue to be regulated because the decision to move, even if it's forced, is belonging to the individual. So the individual, you have to address the environment of the individual as a state. You have to address the environment of the individual in order for you to be able to create a proper, balanced, healthy environment for the individual not to be forced to go. Otherwise, if you have a number of displaced people increasing every year and year, it means that you are not doing something right. And it means that your means of adaptation, your work towards adaptation is not sufficient. So you have to do more than that. So again, but there is a lot else on behalf of the state which can be done in order to actually address displacement.
Professor, earlier you were speaking about healthy environments, voluntary and forced migration. So in furtherance of that, I have a question regarding the possibility of developing a criteria for climate displacement, given this transboundary nature. In other words, given that every nation and every region will be experiencing climate change and is already experiencing climate change and consequently climate migration, albeit to different extent, how would you, or rather, is it possible to develop a framework or criteria for recognizing climate refugees or migration due to climate change?
Okay, I will do my best to be brief because this is a one semester class kind of answer. Displacement is already happening. And as I said before, it will go to increase. It starts always internally. People are moving themselves internally from one state to another, from one household to another, from one relative to another, depending on for how long they there is a tendency. For example, it's a statistics on the number of the young people who are moving from rural areas to cities. It's called urbanization. And this is also addressing displaced people, people running away from rural areas where they cannot support their livelihoods in order to find new economic means. The economics is a threshold. The economic is always in the mind of the migrant, regardless if it's a migrant or it's forced migrant, because the economics is a very huge component of our lives and implicitly of our thinking. So when you are looking for a solution, regardless what type of solution is, if, for example, education, medical, social, if you are thinking about family reunifications and so on, it always has an economic component. Can I afford to do that? How much will that cost me? What are the economic benefits which this will bring me, for example, and so on. As a student, if you are attending a good school, you are expecting a high economic revenue after that because of the association with that name of the school. So this is always an economic component. It's in the mind of the migrant or and the forced migrant. So we are not covering that. But always displacement starts internally in a country. And then if the country fails in general, in all the regions, in all the states, to provide that environment, secure environment, for that protection those displaced persons are looking for, then they were going to cross border. They were going to cross the border. And when they are going to cross the border in neighboring countries, well, unfortunately, they will not have an immediate status, mainly because they are not covered by the Refugee Convention. I'll get back to that in a second, or any of the other international treaties, conventions, agreements, except if two countries have a bilateral agreement on this matter, which is not the case for now, except the Caribbean, the countries from the Caribbean, then you are not being protected. Why you are not a refugee? And talking about terminology, why climate refugees is not the correct terminology? Well, because simply climate is not regulated under the 1951 Refugee Convention. The 1951 Refugee Convention under Article 1 defines what a refugee is, and it has five stressors why you can come, why you can become, I'm sorry, you can become a refugee. And none of the stressors is related to the environment. The answer here is very simple. Why is not related to the environment? Because the environment cannot be considered a persecutor. Yeah, you have to be persecuted in order to obtain a refugee status, an asylum seeker, later a refugee status. And the environment cannot persecute you because you cannot put the environment in court as a subject of law, as a subject of national law or international law. You cannot bring environment to answer for its facts. So that's why it's not considered to be a subject of law. Implicitly, it's not a persecutor. Implicitly, it's not in the 1951 convention. Implicitly, you don't have climate refugees. They do not exist. You have migrants, climate displaced people who are being regulated largely under the humanitarian law, being allowed to somehow reside or not within a foreign country. But you do not have climate refugees because the 1951 convention doesn't say anything about that. Well, when it starts internally and then it goes cross border, it also shows that the people are looking for safe place for protection. And if they cannot get that within their own countries, then they are going to go into other countries. We had a wave of refugees in Europe, for example, a few years back, and everyone was panicking. Obviously, this is a different discussion due to media obsession of migrants coming to conquer Europe. Well, those migrants weren't coming and taking the boats to go from Africa to Europe. They didn't go just for the trip. They didn't go just for economic benefits. They were taking those boats as the last option they had within their own countries to a safe place, to receive protection. Yeah, and some of them were even related to the environment, to climate change. Because if we are thinking of some villages on the coast of North Africa, especially the Northwest Africa or the West of Africa, where they do not have any access anymore to food in the oceans, well, you cannot blame those people for trying to secure their economic income in different places. And Europe could be one of them. So you see, countries have a reluctancy towards climate migrants, although a German court recently allowed or you have another case in 2014 of a New Zealand court allowing families for residents in those countries. However, that was based on humanitarian grounds, and humanitarian grounds can be so largely, however, unfortunately, is not regulated, and it is at the discretion of the courts. So not something in stone. We had some attempts with the Global Compact on orderly migration a few years back. We had another compact, Global Compact on refugees. Both of them are very shyly addressing displacement, and they're very shyly of forcing the countries, obliging the country somehow to have an answer to that. So that displaced number of people, which we discussed at the beginning of this podcast, tripled in the last years, will going to increase, and then obviously will gonna reverse over the borders in different other countries as well.
Thank you so much, Professor. Again, I think the part where you defined what a refugee is as per the Refugee Convention and explain how that is a problem to allowing climate migrants to migrate, it brings me back to, as you said, terminology is important. Now, before we end this episode, Professor, something that we've heard you say before in your COP webinar, and which even we at Climate at the Final Stand really believe in, is youth-based effort. So what message would you like to give to our young listeners for what they can do, not only in terms of climate migration or climate-induced displacement, but in terms of climate change in general? What is your message?
Well, the message is simple. Stay restless. And do something about it. Do something about it and get out of your comfort zone, staying, you know, on iPads, computers, phones, screens, whatever in general, being somehow comfortable in the parents' house or being somehow comfortable with your school grades. Get out of your comfort zone and do something about it. Rage. Do something, anything, which will show that you actually care about that. And you don't know that. You know, nobody can predict the future. You don't know how climate change will affect you in 40 or 50 years. About that time, you're going to have your own children or your own families, and that the responsibilities will double, if not more. So you need to do something now before it's too late. The young generation actually is facing the biggest challenge of our century, this climate change issue. However, the young generation is the most equipped element of society to actually be bold, be active, and go over this political aspect of it and do something about it. Because you are the ones, not necessarily that you are going to be more affected than the older generations. I don't want to go in this unreasonable comparison, but I will say that you are the ones which have all the information, all the knowledge, all the capacity in general to actually do this right. Because you had the bad examples under your eyes, you had the bad examples in the past. And someone smarter than me once said that if we don't learn from history, we are living for nothing. So I will say, learn from what you see. Learn from what you see on TV, learn from what you see around you, learn from what you see in regards to how environment is degrading itself around you. Learn from what you see, which is happening around you, and is nothing so concrete, and it has a lot of political aspects at the end of the day nobody cares about. And learn, and then put it to action. put it to action, stay restless, get involved. In Glasgow, I was so happy to see so many young people being present every day in front of the avenue where the COP26 took place, and being so active in the panels. You see younger and younger generations take over and having a completely different discourse. And that discourse is coming from this frustration, which you should have in regards to climate change. Because trust me, if you don't feel it yet, at some point in your time, in your life, you will. That's my message.
Excellent, Professor. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time, and thank you for coming with us to another episode of The Climate Stand with The Final Stand.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also thank our listeners for tuning in, and we hope you reach out to us with any thoughts or feedback you may have. While there is a lot to learn about the climate crisis, we hope you stay restless and curious and join us every alternate Saturday to unravel a new aspect of it right here at The Climate Stand with The Final Stand.